Hello, welcome to The Ant Hill, a podcast from The Conversation. I'm Will DeFreitas.
And I'm Annabelle Bly.
In this episode, we've got music on our minds. We'll be hearing about the science of what music does to our brains and delving into the history of national anthems and what it takes for music to move people.
But first up, have you ever had a song stuck in your head playing on a loop? You think it's gone, but it keeps just coming back. I'm constantly ridiculed in the office for having the bell chimes in my head that ring every half an hour from a local clock tower.
The technical term for that is an earworm. We wanted to find out more about how these earworms work and how to get rid of them. So Annabelle and I called up Kelly Jakubowski, a music psychologist at Durham University. Kelly has written for The Conversation about her research into which songs are most frequently cited as earworms and why.
We started by asking her what it is about certain songs that makes them get stuck in our heads.
So we've done some research looking at specifically the musical features that make an earworm. So are there certain features of the melody or the tempo or the rhythm that make a song get stuck in our head more than another? And what we found is earworm songs tend more likely to be faster tempo songs. So they tend to be more upbeat songs than slower songs. And they tend to have certain features of the melody. So in terms of the pitch contour, and what I mean by pitch contour is the ups and downs in the pitch of the melody. So earworm tunes tend to make use of quite simple, generic pitch contours. So if you think of things like nursery rhyme songs like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star that have this sort of up and down pattern that are quite predictable. But we've also found that in some cases they also tend to occasionally make use of some sort of unique pitch intervals, such as a larger leap in pitch than you would expect in your sort of average pop song, or more leaps in pitch than you would expect in your sort of average pop song. So it's this sort of combination of a quite simple, generic, overall melodic structure, but with something a bit unpredictable, like a large leap or something like this. We think the brain latches on to this sort of, you know, predictable structure, but also is likes that element of surprise.
Just to be clear, when you say sort of big leap in pitch, you mean sort of going from very low notes to suddenly very high notes?
Or vice versa. Yeah. So if you think of, for instance, the song Somewhere Over the Rainbow, somewhere over the rainbow, that starts with a very big leap. That's not particularly an earworm tune that we've had named, but something like that.
So are there kind of particular examples of songs that listeners might know that have been particularly earwormy?
In terms of the top named earworm songs that we had in our study, the top two songs that we had were Bad Romance by Lady Gaga was the top named earworm song. And then we also had, kind of ironically, the second earwormiest song that we had named was Can't Get You Out of My Head by Kylie Minogue.
That's pretty fitting. Do you find that there are people that are more susceptible to getting earworms stuck in their heads? So it's not necessarily just the type of music, but some people just get songs stuck more than others.
Yep. So there's definitely a lot of what we call individual differences between people. So we know that people that engage with music more frequently anyway tend to get more earworms. And it doesn't necessarily even have to be professional musicians that get more earworms, but people that attribute a high value to music in their life. So people that go to a lot of concerts, listen to a lot of music in general. But we also know some personality factors predict how often people get earworms. So people that score high, for instance, on personality factors of openness to experience and neuroticism. So people that tend to worry or be more anxious also tend to get more earworms. And these people that score high in neuroticism also tend to be more worried by their earworms as well. So tend to find it a slightly more disturbing experience.
Are they triggered by certain things? And do you know, kind of, if you have an earworm, what's the best way to get rid of it?
So probably, again, unsurprisingly, the most common trigger tends to be just recent exposure to music. So if you've recently heard a song, especially if you've repeatedly heard a song, you're more likely to get it stuck in your head. But we have other triggers as well. So we do actually quite frequently get people reporting earworms of songs they haven't heard in weeks or months, but that just get triggered by seeing a word that reminds you of a lyric of a song, or maybe seeing a person or an image that reminds you of a song. So it doesn't necessarily necessarily have to be a song that we've heard recently. And in terms of getting rid of songs that are in our heads, so we've done some research where we surveyed around 1,000 people and asked them how they get rid of their earworms and what are the strategies that work the best for them. And we had three big classes of strategies. So the first strategy is the class of people that really said they couldn't do much to get rid of their earworms. So some people that just said, I have to let it fade away on its own. And if I try to do anything to get rid of it, it just makes it worse. So these kind of passive strategies we had quite frequently. But we also had some people using active strategies. So they actually did something to get rid of their earworms. The most common were actually engaging with the earworm song. So for instance, by finding it on YouTube and playing it all the way through, even repeatedly all the way through, to get rid of that looping nature, to get some sort of closure with the song. And then we had people that distracted themselves with different songs. And the most common song people used actually to displace their earworms without it becoming an earworm itself was the song God Save the Queen.
Really? God Save the Queen? Because yeah. I've heard that Happy Birthday is often used as a kind of antidote.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Yeah, I could see that working as well. So it tends to be, again, like I said, earworms tend to be sort of, you know, these upbeat, more catchy melodies. You know, Happy Birthday tends to be a fairly slow song and not that interesting. God Save the Queen, I think, is a similar, you know, this kind of hymn-like song. And so, I think, you know, in a different population, in a different country, you know, maybe people use different songs as well. But in the UK, at least, that seemed to be the top named sort of earworm displacer.
I'd like to think people around the world do actually use God Save the Queen. I'm interested in whether people can make an earworm deliberately. You know, obviously something like a big Lady Gaga song will have gone through, you know, loads of rewrites. There'll be whole teams of producers and everything. Is that any different from just generally writing a catchy song, or are there specific tricks that producers are now exploiting?
I think that probably a lot of producers and composers are doing this quite intuitively. So they don't necessarily need advice from researchers on how to, you know, this is the formula and this is the way to write an earworm tune. Like I said, there are some melodic features that we found, like tempo and the pitch contour of melodies, that can predict the earworminess of a song. But there's a lot of other features that haven't been researched yet. So we haven't looked into things like how lyrics play a role, how the instrumentation plays a role, and so on. So I would say that, you know, at the moment, this composition of earworms is being done quite intuitively. And, you know, once people have sort of figured out the formula, I think they figure it out and they go with it. I mean, so for instance, Lady Gaga not only had the top named earworm song in our list, but she had two other songs in the top 10. So she seems to have figured out this formula.
Cool.
Were there any other songs that were perhaps kind of equally popular but didn't register as earworms?
So what we did in our study actually to figure out the melodic features of earworms is we actually matched the top named earworm songs. So we had songs that were reported really frequently as earworms, and then we compared them to a body of songs that had never been named as earworms in our survey of 3,000 participants. So we had these sort of, we could make this comparison between earwormy and non-earwormy or less earwormy tunes. And so we had, for instance, Lady Gaga's Bad Romance was the top earworm tune, and it was matched to Lady Gaga's song called Just Dance, which was an equally popular song but had never been named as an earworm in our survey. So it seems we have even certain artists that are writing certain tunes, some of which become earworms and some of which are less likely to.
And you sort of don't really understand why that's the case.
Well, basically, the reason that we did this was so that we could compare those sets of tunes in terms of the melodic features. Okay, so basically, we know that songs like Bad Romance and Just Dance are equally popular in terms of their chart status, but then we compared those in terms of the melodic features that I talked about earlier. And so that's how we figured out that earworm tunes tend to make use of these certain faster tempos, these quite simple pitch interval structures and so on, as opposed to the non-earworm tunes, which didn't make use of those things as much.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, I know Bad Romance certainly is fast tempo. It does have the up and down thing on the chorus. I certainly won't.
Go on, Will.
Give it a go at singing it. And does it, I don't know, well, it does have a kind of stop-start bit, doesn't it? With the, just thinking of the interval pattern.
So, you know, the chorus has that quite generic contour. Da 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 da. But it also has those little interesting interval leaps that I talked about before. So da 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 da. So I would say in terms of the pitch interval content, it is quite interesting, yes. And the average tempo is about the average tempo you would expect for an earworm song.
Sorry, everyone. You'll probably have Bad Romance in your head now. Don't worry, though. We'll be exploring the power of national anthems later in this podcast, which should hopefully cure you of any residual earworms.
Next up, we're burrowing deeper into the brain to find out what happens inside our heads when we listen to music. It turns out that diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, or strokes, can all teach us about how music is processed in the brain, and also how to use music to treat brain damage.
Our science editor Miriam Frankel met three scientists looking into what music can do to our minds, and they've got some moving stories to tell.
In neurologist Oliver Sacks' memoir, Awakenings, catatonic patients with sleeping sickness suddenly come back to life temporarily when given the drug L-DOPA, after decades of being in a statue-like condition. But it's perhaps less well known that there was something much simpler that could help them wake up for short moments of time. Music. There have even been cases where music has helped wake coma patients up for good. Jörg Fachner, a professor of music, health and the brain at Anglia Ruskin University, told me the fascinating story of how one of his colleagues in Germany managed to wake a patient up from a coma in the 1990s by simply singing to him.
So what was happening is that she was going into an intensive care unit. And you can imagine all the apparatus, they're beeping, the doors are, you know, slamming. And so, and then there is a person in a coma and they are asked, "What's your name?" No answer. The people are lying there, no response. So what she did is she was sitting beside this person, taking his hand and then watching his breathing and detected the metrum of the breathing. And then what she did was singing simple melodies. When he was inhaling, she was singing a note. And when he was exhaling, she was singing a note. And by this, she was entraining to the body rhythms of that particular person. And it didn't take a long time. Then this person was awakening.
He had been in a coma for 2 years. And when he'd recovered, the man explained that he felt like he had been a knight wounded on a battlefield. When he heard Jörg's colleague singing, he thought she was a nun.
When the nun came and was singing to him, it seemed to be a safe place again. And this safe place then made him think, okay, now I can open my eyes. And now I can see where the battle has gone and maybe now I'm safe. So creating a safe space is a basic principle of music therapy.
It seems music can have near magical properties when it comes to healing us. We know that some patients with severe dementia, who cannot even remember their own name, can remember entire song lyrics. And some patients who can barely talk or walk can sing to communicate or move to music. But how can music be so powerful? What happens in the brain when we hear it? There's actually a lot we don't know about the neurological basis of music cognition. But pathological cases like stroke, Parkinson's and dementia have been hugely important in neuroscientists' understanding of how music is processed in the brain. And over the past few decades, they have identified music-specific disorders which also offer insights, such as congenital amusia, that's the medical term for tone deafness, and musical hallucinations. But let's start with the basics. Here's Lauren Stewart, a professor at Goldsmiths University of London, who studies the neuroscience of music, explaining what we know about how the brain processes music. Oh, by the way, that's Lauren's five-month-old baby who sat in on our interview.
Now, in terms of perceiving music, it's true to say that there is no centre for the musical brain because there's so many different components to music. You can think of the rhythmic aspect, the timbral aspect, the pitch and melodic aspect. And even these domains break down into smaller domains. So for rhythm, you can think about duration and meter. For melody, you can think about contour and interval. And we know from studying patients who've had strokes that have affected different parts of the brain, we know that you can selectively lose quite independent parts of the musical system. So we've kind of, by looking across the published literature of musical deficits following stroke, we've basically mapped out different areas of the brain that are selectively involved in the processing of different musical attributes. But of course, when we listen to real music, it involves all of those attributes together. And so we can think of a symphony of a sort of neuronal processing, bringing all these areas together.
So what happens when one part of the brain is injured? Let's look at the example of people who have lost their ability to comprehend and formulate language following something like a stroke or a head injury. In very rare cases, people with this condition, called aphasia, can actually be taught to communicate by singing.
There is a therapy called melodic intonation therapy, which involves a therapist working very intensely with those with aphasia. And after many, many months and hundreds of hours, sometimes these patients can sing back simple things. And the idea there is that perhaps it's the sort of the heightened arousal that a musical framework provides that is allowing speech to occur. Or it may be that the melody is engaging some intact areas of the brain that are not involved in the brain damage. Or it may be the rhythmic framework is allowing speech, sort of scaffolding the speech production.
Amazingly, music isn't just able to help us communicate. It can also help us move. Lauren has also done research with stroke survivors who struggle with movement, which shows that music can greatly boost the amount of physiotherapy they do, helping them to get better faster. Dramatic impact on movement has also been seen in patients with Parkinson's disease, which mainly affects the motor system, leading to tremors and difficulty to move. This degenerative disorder destroys something called the basal ganglia in the brain, a group of structures that help us coordinate our movement, telling us when to start and stop moving. Lauren's colleague, Maria Herojo Ruiz, a lecturer in psychology at Goldsmiths, tells me what she has learned about how music affects people with Parkinson's disease from a study that planted electrodes in the brain of patients to monitor the basal ganglia.
So one of the things that we investigated relates to how Parkinsonian patients cannot generate their own cues to move, for instance. If you think of a typical disorder in Parkinson's disease is a gait, the problem of gait. So when they walk, and not so much during walking, but at the beginning and at the end of walking. So they have problems in initiating and terminating a sequence of actions. That's because the brain needs to generate cues that trigger movements. You can have the cues trigger internally, so your brain can induce those cues that tell you now start moving, now stop moving. Or you could have external help, such as external stimuli, for instance, a metronome. So what has been shown is that because Parkinsonian patients cannot generate those cues internally, if you use a metronome or music as an external stimulus, they can move.
Maria and her team also trained the patients with the brain implants to play simple piano sequences and looked at how their brainwave patterns change when they start and stop playing. One of these patients was actually a pianist and still able to play, though struggling with his right hand. They found that all the patients, except the pianist, lacked a certain modulation in the rhythm of the brain activity at the beginning and at the end of the sequence that a healthy person would have. The study didn't test whether the pianist could walk better than the others as well, but Maria says that is the kind of follow-up experiment needed next. Potentially, this could mean that playing music will make you better at staving off the effects of Parkinson's for longer. And perhaps a simple app playing the right kind of sounds could one day help patients move around their house. As well as studying musicians and musical therapy, there's a lot to learn from the patients with congenital amusia, or tone deafness. Returning to Laura now, she built a study that got hundreds of thousands of people to participate after she published it alongside an article on the BBC News website. based on a test originally developed by Isabelle Peretz at the University of Montreal. It gets people to compare two tunes and say whether they're exactly the same or slightly different. For people who aren't tone deaf, it should be straightforward.
So might be like da 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 versus da 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 da. So like a wrong note in the second tune, which most people would sound really, really glaringly obvious, but people with amusia very often don't hear the difference. We wanted to look further into this disorder, and as I say, we managed to identify a small group of people who were scoring in that bottom range, and we called them into the lab and we did the full battery and we tested their hearing and we tested their memory and we made sure that they didn't have any learning difficulties that could explain this difficulty with music. And then we did a number of different studies.
One study looked at whether people who are tone deaf also have trouble understanding speech because they can't process the rhythm and the patterns of sounds. She found that people with amusia do have subtle difficulties with this.
It's just that in the course of everyday communication, the intonation in speech is very often rather exaggerated compared to the pitch movement that you get in music. So in music, the most common interval is a semitone. But in speech, my voice in particular has quite large leaps in terms of pitch. And so normally, people with amusia can hear largish pitch changes. And the other thing about speech is that very often you get a lot of information from context.
It had previously been assumed that there are two independent pitch processing mechanisms in the brain, one that dealt with speech and another that dealt with music or other sounds. But Lauren's study showed that this isn't necessarily the case. A few brain scanning studies have shown subtle structural differences in the brains of those with amusia in areas that are important in language and the processing of auditory information. But there's some inconsistency in the findings, and scientists are still trying to work out what really distinguishes people with a condition. Clearly, there is a lot we don't know about how music is processed in the brain and why it differs among individuals. Perhaps one of the most fascinating and strange conditions is musical hallucinations. This is a very rare and terrifying disorder in which people hear music that isn't actually playing. It can be caused by a range of conditions, including brain lesions, hearing loss, and epilepsy. Jorg tells me that, unlike visual hallucinations, which seem to activate the visual parts of the brain's cortex, musical hallucinations seem to activate a wide variety of areas in the brain, including those processing emotions. Fascinatingly, Jorg has personal experience of what it's like living with a condition, as he has a relative who is haunted by the sound of Nazi songs from his childhood.
He was a little boy when the Nazis were on and they were inviting the kids to, you know, to learn songs. And of course, they had these songs which were of political nature, and he learned these songs. And they had this radio station where the Führer was talking, and he was sometimes talking loud. And so in his older days now, he had, you know, these percepts that he had as a little boy, and the songs that they were singing, they were haunting him. They were suddenly appearing, you know, when he's becoming emotional on whatever it is, then suddenly he was listening to this bloody voice that he said in the background, and he just wants to get rid of it and he can't. And it was really trying to find medication for it. And there's some that helps a little bit, which is an antidepressant medication, and it acts on a part of the neurotransmitter system, which is related to how we are, you know, relaxing in a way and not becoming anxious. But there is no clear picture how we can treat that properly.
As terrifying as that sounds, let's not forget that music can actually be healing beyond our wildest dreams. While the neuroscience of music cognition is still a developing science, it's exciting to think about what miracles that researchers may one day be able to perform. In the meantime, do enjoy your music, whatever it is. It may help keep you going a lot longer than you could ever imagine.
That was Miriam Frankel, the Conversation Science Editor.
So we've heard some of the things that music can do to the brain, but what about how it makes you feel? Is there a particular way of writing music that moves us emotionally? To find out, our arts editor Jonathan Est went off to learn more about those pieces of music that are specifically designed to make us feel part of something bigger, national anthems.
No matter how divided the world we live in, one thing every country has in common is that we all identify with a flag and a national anthem. And whether you think they're profoundly moving or downright corny, there's no doubting the power of national anthems to unify millions of people with a sense of national identity. So what is it about national anthems that seem to instill such a sense of patriotism in so many people? Ian Biddle is a music lecturer at Newcastle University who studies music and nationalism, particularly in Europe. He told me that the first country to adopt a piece of music and words as its national anthem was actually Britain. Britain officially opted for God Save the King, or as we know it, of course, God Save the Queen, in the 1740s.
There are national anthems that have origins earlier than that, but were not adopted until later. So the Spanish Marcha Real, for example, was adopted in the latter part of the 18th century, and many national anthems were not adopted until the middle of the 19th century. So it's our own national anthem that is the earliest that we know of.
The decision to adopt an official national song came out of a need to heal political wounds after a bitter conflict.
This is the period just after the Jacobite Rebellion, and there was a feeling that Britain had, you know, work to do in terms of persuading its citizens to attach to the idea of Britishness. So a national anthem, along with several other resources, was one of the things it used to cement the emotional idea of the nation, if you like.
Many countries followed suit in the 18th and 19th centuries, and, like Britain, many were looking to heal political wounds. While some chose military tunes, others looked for something more spiritual.
I mean, many nations certainly use military music, so the Marcha Real in Spain is a march tune. Similarly, the Marseillaise in France is a march-like tune. And the Brabançon in Belgium has also got a march-like tune, very similar tune in many ways to the Marseillaise. So there are those sort of military musical backgrounds and ideological backgrounds, but many of them are quite sort of bland musical hymns, really, almost religious in tone, that are doing a very different kind of work to the march-like tunes. Those hymn-like tunes, I think, are trying to portray something about the nation that stands in for what we might think of as the lost god of Enlightenment thinking. You know, as European culture was becoming ever more secular, the nation state stands in the place of the old idea of the divine rights of kings and monarchs. So there is that kind of religious need as well, a kind of quasi-religious replacement in the national anthem, if you like.
This religiosity is not just relayed by the words to national anthems, but the music as well.
They tend to be of a certain style of music, quite an ancient style. Many of the tunes go back a very long way.
Ian gives the example of the British national anthem.
God Save the Queen or God Save the King is a tune that we think is an old plain song tune. So as early as maybe the 11th century, maybe even earlier. It may even come from before there, and it's been adapted to new musical idioms and styles. So that's how we might think about it musically. They share this hymn-like quality. But then we might also ask the question in terms of, well, why do they affect us in the way they do? And I think for me that is best answered by understanding the history of anthems. They come about as the result of a need to cement the idea of the nation at a particular time when the nation state as a political idea was becoming very popular, particularly, I would say, in the early to mid 19th century.
So, in their own ways, both the words and the music are equally important in conveying this national message. Ian takes the example of the Dutch national anthem.
What's striking about the Dutch national anthem, for example, is that it's words written during the time of the Dutch Republic to a tune that comes from sometime in the early 16th century we think that was originally set to words that were actually quite hostile to the Protestant ideology of the Dutch Republic. And so, you know, a tune can move from one place to another and you just add new words and it takes on a new meaning. So those words are important, but the tune doesn't necessarily carry quite that explicit ideological meaning that the words might. So often what you find is nations adopt tunes that they like and then do away with the old words and put something on the top. So historically, that would suggest that it's the combination of words and melody together that really affects the final outcome of the anthem, which is this attempt to get us to emotionally identify with the idea of the nation.
So we've heard how national anthems appeal in their lyrics to a sense of allegiance to the idea of a nation. But what about the cadences of the music and the way they move people? To find out more, I went to meet Elaine Chu, who is both a musician and an academic. She's a professor of digital media at Queen Mary, University of London, and is also an accomplished classically trained pianist. Her most recent project concerns using computers and maths to find out what it is about music and the performance of music that moves people, as national anthems are designed to do. She explained why music and mathematics have so much in common.
Music is particularly mathematical because its properties are highly quantifiable. Things like pitch, frequencies, the duration, it's a number, the onset time and offset times, the loudness at which you hear a sound. Even things like timbre are quantifiable as sort of the combination of the harmonics that generates that sound. So music in some ways, like many things, I guess, in life, can sort of be decomposed into a set of numbers. And then we start thinking about how to find the relationships between the numbers to group like and like, or what is similar, what is different.
Elaine used her knowledge of maths and music theory to explain what it is about the actual music of national anthems, the notes and the time signatures, that makes them so effective in bringing the people of a country together.
I think a lot of national anthems have this rising fourth, da-dum, ba-dum, da-dum, da-dum. That's kind of, it's like a horn bugle call. It has a very uplifting feeling. It has that maybe call to arms kind of feel to it. It's generally very happy and upbeat. You don't have convoluted things happening in national anthems, sort of twisted chord progressions that make you think, ooh, what's happening? They tend to be fairly straightforward and inviting.
She believes many national anthems are composed, or chosen to be national anthems, because they can be marched to, and that means many of them are written in a certain time signature.
We did look at the rhythmic patterns of national anthems in one study, and they tend to be marches in 4-4 time, things that you can march to, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, if you want something that you can march to, it has to be in duple meter, in groups of 2, 4. I mean, it could be, you know, 1, 2, 3, 2, 2, 3, but it has to have that grouping of being able to group into twos. And you need that to be able to walk to it because we have two legs and we need to alternate between them, so it needs to be an even number.
Ian also believes that, by and large, national anthems conform to a certain musical type.
Yes, I mean, the most of them have in common is this hymn-like tone, a certain speed of performance, and they're usually in the major key. There are one or two exceptions to that. For example, the Catalan national anthem is in the minor key. That's quite rare. It has a sort of mournful, sad tone, and Catalans themselves say that reflects their history.
While the Catalan national anthem is unusual in its mournful nature, reflecting the Spanish province's long struggle to be recognised as an independent nation, perhaps the most unusual current national anthem is a modern South African anthem.
I think the South African national anthem is really wonderful, not least because it's in five languages. It's in English, Zulu, Afrikaans, Xhosa and Sesotho, and it's two tunes rammed together. And it's a lovely kind of musical expression of the so-called Rainbow Nation, this attempt to try and bring different cultural spaces and inheritances and so on together in the service of the idea of the nation.
So remember, national anthems are chosen to move people. Next time you hear a national anthem played at a sporting event or a public ceremony, remember, it's music that has been chosen expressly to stir up a warm feeling of patriotism. Whether you personally are moved or not is another matter.
Jonathan Est there, the Conversation's arts editor.
That's it for this episode of The Anthill. I have finally got Bad Romance out of my head. Now I just need to go and get rid of God Save the Queen.
Tune in again next month when we'll be asking what's left to explore and should we go there in an episode delving into unexplored places.
The Anthill is brought to you by The Conversation, where you can find lots more interesting comment and analysis from academics at theconversation.com. And do sign up to our free daily newsletter. If you enjoy the podcast, please tell your friends about us and give us a review on iTunes or whichever podcatcher you are using at the moment.
A big thanks to all the academics who spoke to us and to the journalism department here at City University for letting us use their studios. This episode of The Anthill was produced by Gemma Ware and my co-host Annabelle Bly. Thanks for listening in. Goodbye.
Goodbye.